Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedures Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, July 5th, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome return guest to Teleforum, Vikrant P. Reddy. He's a senior research fellow at the Charles Koch Institute. He's going to give us some background on the case and talk about the decision, going about 15 or 20 minutes or so. But as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so please have those in mind. With that, Vikrant Reddy, the floor is yours.
Thanks so much, Dean. I really appreciate being invited to do this. I just want to say thank you to the Federalist Society, and as usual, I want to thank John Malcolm and all the members of the Criminal Law Practice Steering Committee that I serve on. It's been a real honor to serve with them and to get to talk about interesting cases like this, to have that forum. So today we're going to talk about Maslenjak versus the United States, and the first thing I should say from the get-go is that I'm not sure whether or not I'm pronouncing Maslenjak correctly. I'm saying the J is a Y. I don't know the languages of the Balkans in Europe, I'm afraid, so maybe it's Maslenjak, maybe it's something a little bit different, but I'm saying Maslenjak. The court decided this case back on June 22nd, and it is basically an immigration case, but what I'm going to do today is talk a bit about the criminal law dimensions of the case, because I think those dimensions are extremely interesting for people who are thinking about the implications of Supreme Court decisions on law and on public policy. And the really important point that I want to communicate to all listeners today is that I view this decision as yet another in a recent line of Supreme Court decisions in which the court seems to be expressing real concern about prosecutorial discretion and overreach. And I think what the court has been trying to do in several recent cases here is look at statutory language and interpret it in a way that reins in prosecutorial discretion. This is another example of that sort of thing. So let's start with the facts. Everybody on the call knows that for most of the 20th century, there was a country in southeastern Europe called Yugoslavia, got engulfed in a terrible civil war in the 1990s, and was broken up into several constituent republics now. There was a woman from Yugoslavia named Divna Maslenjak. She was Serbian, and she lived in the Bosnian part of the country at the time of the civil war. And she sought asylum in the United States. She made the argument when she was talking with U.S. immigration officials that she and her family were really subject to persecution on all sides of this war. They were subject to persecution from the Bosnian side because they were not Bosnian, they were Serbs. And they were subject to persecution on the Serbian side because although they were Serbian, her husband actually was a war deserter. Rather than join the Serbian army to go and fight the Bosnian Muslims, he actually escaped, he deserted, and he lived in hiding for about 5 years. And as you can imagine, this was not viewed kindly by fellow Serbians. Well, the immigration officials accepted the story, and they granted asylum to both her and her husband in 1998. Then in 2004, Ms. Maslenjak applies for naturalization. She actually earns naturalization in 2007. And in her naturalization application, she actually states that she had never in the past given false or misleading information while seeking any kind of immigration benefit. This was not true. This was a lie, because she had lied about her husband when originally seeking asylum. It turns out that he was not, in fact, a war deserter. He did fight in the Serbian army. In fact, he was an officer in the Serbian army. And in fact, for those of you who are familiar with the politics of that region, his unit participated in the very infamous massacre in Srebrenica or Srebrenica. That's another word that I'm not good with pronouncing. But people will be familiar with this awful massacre of 8,000 Bosnian Muslims that took place in 1995. When the immigration officials discovered these facts about her husband, they sought to deport him. Ms. Maslenjak tried to prevent that deportation, and in the course of those proceedings, she ended up confessing that she knew about her husband's background and his involvement in this unit. So, in order to gain asylum, and later in order to gain naturalization, she had in fact lied. When the prosecutors discovered this, they sought to revoke her citizenship under a statute, 18 U.S.C. 1425A. 1425A makes it a crime to, quote, knowingly procure, contrary to law, the naturalization of any person. So the key phrase there is contrary to law. The government argued that Maslenjak had acted contrary to law because she lied. And there's a different statute, 18 U.S.C. 1015, which prohibits knowingly making a false statement under oath in a naturalization proceeding. As they saw it, she lied. Therefore, she violated 1425. It was an act contrary to law. Now, Maslenjak objected to this argument. She said that the lie was not material. The lie needed to be material in order for the for conviction to be found. Now, this went to the district court, and the interesting thing is that the district court told the jury, I should quote the language here, that conviction would be proper if, quote, the government proved that one of the defendant's statements was false. It said nothing about materiality. And the jury convicted her, and she lost her U.S. citizenship. This then went to the Sixth Circuit. The Sixth Circuit upheld the jury instruction, and so they affirmed the conviction. There's a different holding, though, in the First Circuit. I don't know the details of the First Circuit case, but I do know that the First Circuit ultimately decided that materiality was necessary, that it wasn't enough to just tell the jury a lie is a lie is a lie. You have to demonstrate materiality. And because of this question of whether or not materiality was relevant, the Supreme Court decided it would take the case in order to resolve the circuit split. So like I said, the court came down with their opinion on June 22nd. It was a decision written by Justice Kagan, and it was unanimous. The court decided that the lie did need to be material, and for that reason, the jury instruction was improper. Justice Kagan, as I said, wrote the opinion, and she pretty succinctly captured the holding in the opinion in the first paragraph, and I'm just going to read this statement to you. She wrote that the government must establish that an illegal act by the defendant played some role in her acquisition of citizenship. So, when the illegal act is a false statement, that means demonstrating that the defendant lied about facts that would have mattered to an immigration official, because they would have justified denying her naturalization. The opinion is really well done. I'm of the view, I bet many people on the call are also, that Justice Kagan, whatever I think of her jurisprudence, and I have some questions there, is nevertheless a very good writer. She's very talented. Probably the best progressive writer on the court. And she goes through a number of really kind of interesting examples in the course of her opinion. The most prominent one is, she says, let's think about how we use language. Suppose I say to you, John obtained a painting illegally. What do we think that means? When we say John obtained a painting illegally, we probably think that he snuck into the museum and plucked it off the wall, you know, that he did something in the course of getting the painting, not just that was illegal on the way to the museum, that he, you know, ran a red light or something like that, but rather that it really was a part of the procurement of the painting, the illegality. In fact, she said, if I had said something like, John obtained a painting illegally, but that had nothing to do, the illegal act, with the procurement of the painting, it would sound like a nonsense phrase. In fact, she said it would sound like the beginning of a child's riddle. And I think that's probably true. I think all the justices obviously agreed with it. It doesn't really make any sense to use language in that way. That's just not how English is spoken. When the immigration officials were considering the statements that she made in order to acquire citizenship, they were concerned with whether or not she was lying about the facts involved in making the citizenship discussion. When they were trying to evaluate whether or not she had acted contrary to law, they weren't looking at things outside of that scope. So, for example, if she went to the federal building, she was carrying a knife illegally on her, and she filled out the application forms and submitted them, and they were all perfectly truthful, she would have been acting contrary to law in the sense that she was carrying an illegal weapon. But that would obviously have nothing to do with the ultimate citizenship decision. And so for that reason, the court decided that materiality really is central here. A lot of other, I guess I would say, fun examples came up during the oral argument, which made a little bit of news when the case was heard several months ago. The justices had a little bit of fun with this. Chief Justice Roberts said, well, look, there was a time, and the statute of limitations has since passed, but there was a time once when I went 60 in a 55. If I lie about this, is that justification for revoking my citizenship? And Justice Sotomayor asked, is it justification to remove my citizenship if I lie about an unflattering childhood nickname? And Justice Kagan even joked, well, heck, what if I lie about my weight? But all of these examples get to a really serious point, which Justice Kennedy made in oral argument. He said, you know, naturalization is essentially the most sacred right that the United States offers. It seems like if you are going to pull that right away, you would need to be doing it for some kind of very serious reason, not just for some triviality. And so simply saying that the person lied is just not adequate. So the court decided that materiality is necessary. And for that reason, because the jury instruction did not include this note about materiality, it'll have to go back to the district court for that decision to be made. I will tell you on a personal note, I don't have a lot of confidence in Ms. Maslenyak's ability to win on that question. It does seem to me that that's quite material, the fact that her husband had participated in this massacre in Srebrenica. But that's where we're headed now, back to the district court. And we have a more clear law that materiality is necessary. It's important to note, as I said, that what I think is most significant about this case and what you saw come through in oral argument and what you saw come through in Justice Kagan's opinion is that they're very concerned that if there wasn't some kind of limiting instruction or some kind of limiting reading into the statute, that you've given extraordinarily broad power to prosecutors to revoke citizenship. You could probably find any number of lies about any number of trivial things, and that's a really, really broad power to hand over to prosecutors. And I think the court was concerned about that. I think they've been concerned about that. It's obviously a major point of national conversation right now. Criminal justice issues are all over the papers, the headlines every single day. And these questions about prosecutorial discretion and prosecutorial abuse have become very significant. They've become significant in a bipartisan way, it's important to note. This case was decided 9-0. There were two concurrences. They were on very technical matters that aren't terribly relevant to the broader point here about prosecutorial discretion. I will note, by the way, just because it's probably interesting to folks on a Federal Society call, that one of the concurrences was written by Justice Gorsuch. We're all very interested in knowing how his decision-making was going to progress. The opinion included a long section in which Justice Kagan tried to, quote, operationalize her decision. All that really means is that she tried to provide some guidance for juries about how they're supposed to assess materiality. And Justice Gorsuch simply said, I don't really know that that's necessary. You know, we made a decision about materiality. I think we got it right. But we should stop at that point. We're not obligated to go any further. Courts need to be a little bit more restrained. And Justice Thomas joined that concurrence. So I thought that was kind of an interesting note about Justice Gorsuch's thinking, which we're all curious about. But again, it's not terribly relevant to this question about materiality and about prosecutorial discretion in cases like this and in all sorts of cases. So that was the case, Maslenyak versus the United States. And as I said, I think we can expect more things like this to happen in the future, where the court will look at statutory language and say, well, the government wants us to read this language in an unbelievably broad way. And if we were to do that, we're going to find ourselves giving far too much power to prosecutors. We're going to have to find a way to read this language a little bit more narrowly.
Very good. Thank you so much. Let's go right to audience questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question, our lines are wide open at this point. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We're speaking with our expert today, Vikrant Reddy, about the recently decided Supreme Court case. While we're waiting to see who rings in, let me make first a quick commercial announcement about our next Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m. at this number, same date, same time. Same time, same number, rather. We'll be talking about Turkey in NATO. For now, if you have a question for Vikrant Reddy, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let me ask the first question, if I could. Vikrant, you mentioned in your opening remarks that this is in today's case that we're talking about is in a line of several recent cases where you believe the court, the Supreme Court, is reining in prosecutorial discretion, trying to sort of construe things along lines more narrow than the prosecutors themselves might be construing authority, lines of authority. Can you say more about that and maybe talk about some of the other cases you think point to sort of a developing jurisprudence here?
Yeah, I'll tell you, one of my favorite cases in recent years, very small, very quirky case, but it's absolutely one of my favorite ones, came, I want to say, in 2014, Yates versus the United States. And a lot of people on the call will know this as, quote, the fish case. And this is the case that involved a fisherman who had, we think, fished for some grouper illegally. And when his boat was being inspected, took, I think, three grouper and chucked them back into the water so that they wouldn't be detected. They were too small. And what the government did was that they charged him under the same crime that they had charged Arthur Andersen executives under for disposing of, quote, tangible objects during the Enron fiasco. That was, you know, these Arthur Andersen people were taking documents and shoving them into shredders. And as the government saw it, when he chucked the fish overboard, he had implicated himself under this law because fish are tangible objects. And he was subject to 20 years in prison for having done this. And this went to the Supreme Court, and you know, the Supreme Court had to determine whether or not a fish is a tangible object. And just like we're talking about today, there's a very broad reading in which you can say, well, you know, you have to give prosecutors the discretion to read this language broadly as they see fit and make the decisions they need to make. On the other hand, you can read the language more narrowly and say, well, you know, a man throwing three fish overboard should not be subject to 20 years in prison. And we do not think that this is the sort of thing that Congress had in mind when they passed the law in the first place. We're going to have to read this language in a way that probably comports more with what the legislators had originally intended. And there's two different ways you can think about this. And what the court decided in that case was, no, it's overbroad. You can't read the statute in this way. And that's the same sort of thing that they did today. They found a way to read the statute a bit more narrowly because I think they're clearly concerned that this is not this kind of very, very vast and very broad prosecutorial discretion. It's probably not what Congress intended when it drafted all this legislation.
Very good. Once again, if you have a question for our expert, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. Let me ask yet another question. Getting a little more specific on the court's jurisprudence, do you have any sense of let me start with this other question. Did the current Department of Justice, that is under the Trump administration, did they stick by this case to the very end? And if so, what does that give us any insights into the Department of Justice or the Solicitor General's office? I suppose they could have had a chance to reverse its position or soften its position along the way, as they've done in some other cases. Maybe you could speak to that issue, if you would.
Yeah, I'm hesitant to comment too much on what's going on at Main Justice. I don't know, but I imagine, you know, they did stick with the case to the very end, and my guess is that from a policy perspective, they weren't too happy with the outcome. Obviously, immigration is a central feature of the new administration's goals and objectives. I think it's pretty clear that they would like a bit more discretion to make these kinds of immigration decisions. They can't have been terribly thrilled about this. I do think ultimately, though, that it's a pretty narrow decision that isn't going to really affect 99% of the kinds of immigration policies that the administration is interested in pursuing. But, you know, every little bit either helps or hurts, and this was a little bit that I think hurt. So I doubt that that AG Sessions was too excited about the outcome.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one caller with a question. Let's head in his or her direction.
Hi, my name is Dagmar Wick, and I'm an immigration attorney, so I followed this case very closely. To say the least, she lied already on the initial asylum case. So she should, it probably would have been denied if she would not have, you know, if she would have mentioned that she is not under persecution on both sides of the fence of Serbia and of Bosnia. So she really, if that, and that case, if that would have been denied, then she wouldn't even have had a chance to apply for citizenship. What are your thoughts about it?
Yeah, I actually do have some thoughts on this. Thank you very much for your question. Because when I talked about this case with friends of mine who are not attorneys, they got very frustrated because they said, well, you know, why do we have to send this back to the district court for a new finding? It's very obvious that this woman lied. She lied about something fairly serious. Why doesn't the Supreme Court just say, okay, you know, we're kicking you out of the country or we're pulling your citizenship? And I said, well, you know, and this is just the way the law works, is that the Supreme Court is not a finder of fact. It's not in a position to make a decision like that. All it was supposed to do was determine this question about materiality. And so they made the decision about materiality, that it is relevant, that it does have to be included in the jury instruction. And so now it goes back to the district court. And I understand that for people outside of law, that's that can be really tedious. But I agree with the questioner that it seems fairly obvious that she did lie, and she lied about something quite serious. And my hunch is that the district court is going to say, okay, we're supposed to consider whether or not this is material. For goodness sakes, yes, this is quite material. And I don't like our odds in the next go around.
Can I have a follow-up?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Tell me.
Yeah, what I mean here is the USCIS, so the Immigration Service, should have gone back to the asylum case and say, well, we granted really asylum by mistake because we were lied to, and she didn't really have a case to even ask for asylum case. So what I don't understand is, yes, and I agree with you that now the district court says, yes, it's material, and therefore we deny the citizenship, you know, take it back. But the immigration should have made this case in the first place, don't you think?
I don't know. It's possibly true. I'm not an immigration lawyer, and I studied the case more from the criminal law perspective, but you're an immigration attorney, and you may be right about that.
Okay, yeah. I was just wondering, because it languished so long in the courts, and probably when you do asylum cases, you have to you know, argue your case that you are persecuted in the countries. And obviously, if she wouldn't have lied, she could not have made her case. You know, so just being an immigration attorney, I see this many times.
Once again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Otherwise, we'll adjourn the call early. Let me ask one more question here. You mentioned briefly in passing legislative history. Did any of the opinions rely in any significant extent on legislative history, or did they just take the statute at face value? And what does that say about the court's use of legislative history either way?
That's a good question. They did not actually mention legislative history in any significant way, and I probably should have been a bit more clear about that. In fact, Justice Kagan begins her opinion by writing something like, we start, as always, with the text of the statute. And I love seeing language like that from the more progressive justices, because it suggests to me that Justice Scalia, whom I personally thought was just wonderful, had a real impact on the way that everybody, left, right, up, down, whatever, thinks about statutes and how they think about language. She really just ran a language analysis, looking at the text of the statute, looking at how plain English is read and is spoken and is considered. And I think it's the kind of opinion that Justice Scalia would have been profoundly proud of, to know that other judges were using this kind of analysis.
Very good. I am now going to make a final call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Vikrant, I think we've had our final question. Let me give you a chance to express any final thought that you might have before we adjourn.
I'm going to end on that final thought about Justice Scalia. I hadn't thought about it, but to be thinking about it makes me happy, kind of warms my heart. I think that's a great stopping point.
Well done, then. Let me thank you on behalf of myself, of course, but also on behalf of the Federalist Society, Vikrant Reddy, for joining us today. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in, and a reminder to the audience about our next scheduled Teleforum conference call. That will be tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. We'll be talking about the nation of Turkey and its role in NATO. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.